Join the conversation.
You're with Cape Talk.
It is really with great excitement that I welcome to the studio a debut novelist who has written what I think is both literally and figuratively one of the hottest novels of the year so far. I'll explain why in just a moment. His name's Alistair Mackay, and he is a writer and marketing strategist who has previously published a lot of work. He's written columns, he's written short stories, news pieces, even, I believe, briefly some political communications along the way. But this is his first book. It's called It Doesn't Have to Be This Way. And it is a doozy. It is a really chilling dystopian vision of Cape Town devastated by climate change and of a society where humanity has been really eclipsed by technology, leading to complete disconnection. And I know that sounds like a really scary framework, but I have to add that it is also at its core a really poignant love story and a story of resilience and of queer identity. Alistair, I really mean it when I say I couldn't put it down. Congratulations, and can't wait to see what else you've got up your sleeve if this is what you do with your first book. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Pippa. Thanks for having me.
Have you been writing since childhood? I mean, you've clearly been doing it professionally for some time, but...
I have. Yeah. I think my first attempt at a novel was when I was about 6 years old.
Okay.
This is the first one that I've managed to get to work.
We still got the draft of the old one in a shoebox somewhere.
Yeah. And various other failed projects along the way.
As we all do. Yeah. Okay. You had the chance to go in and study at Columbia University, didn't you? And I know that was really sort of seminal in influencing this work.
It was. It was an incredible experience. So I did my MFA, my Master in Fine Arts in Creative Writing at Columbia. And I worked on the early drafts of this novel in my thesis workshop at Columbia. And that's just an amazing experience, because every week you're having to turn in a new chapter or a new short story, and you just sit there and you're not allowed to say a word, and you get critiqued by all the other writers in the room. But it was really, really helpful. I met some amazing, amazing, inspirational people there.
I mean, that's one way to make sure you keep on writing. Yes. Nobody's going to accept writer's block as an excuse, I would imagine.
No, absolutely
yeah.
not.
Okay. And I mean, how long ago was that when you first started ruminating on the concept of this novel?
So the ironic thing is that it was before Day Zero.
Really?
Yes. No. Oh, okay. So I had this idea for this book, maybe 6-7 years ago, and then I started seriously trying to write it around about the time I went to Columbia. So 2015, okay. Yeah, I was really trying to get it out. I sort of had a concept of the world I wanted to create early on, and this dystopian future. And then the thing I struggled most with was getting the characters right. You know, as you mentioned, I didn't want it to be relentlessly bleak. I wanted there to be some hope in it, and some characters that people fall in love with.
Yeah, absolutely.
And root for. Yeah.
So, speaking of the relentless bleakness, I mean, let's go there. This is a world. I mean, there's one thing that's very familiar. It's a city divided between the haves and the have-nots, as we are now. But when we first see the city in this novel, it's a complete nightmare. So the rich are living cocooned in a secure estate on Signal Hill. It's got a glass dome over the top. It's got climate control. It's got vertical gardens. It's got desalination plants. So they're able to continue life, I don't want to say as normal, and I'll explain why just now, but to some degree of normality. Outside those walls, it is a total nightmare. It is a city consumed by rising sea levels, blistering heat. There is 100% unemployment. There are people scraping out, I won't even call it a living, just scraping out from hour to hour to keep themselves alive as the shacklands sprawl over what is left of standable land. And it is so hot that you literally cannot move in the midday hours. And we really mean that, Alistair. It's not just you can't move around conveniently or comfortably. Your characters have to spend a part of the day lying in complete stillness.
Absolutely. So that their body temperature doesn't rise too much as if they move. Yeah.
It's quite a frightening, it's a very frightening thing, but the stuff of nightmares. But really, what was the most scary for me, because as you take us back in time to trace the path of how we got here, it is so very, very believable, particularly having then gone through Day Zero, and Day Zero and COVID are referenced in the book. That sort of gradual slide downhill towards climate change is relentless. So that's what's happening outside the walls. Okay, so inside the walls of the security state called the Citadel, I said life sort of normal. It's not really, because life there is also anything but normal. There is a second nightmare going on there, which is a world completely overtaken by technology. And again, something that is futuristic but utterly believable given the pace of technological advancement. I mean, talk to us about the inspiration for that vision of what we have become in the future.
So I think as a South African, it's not hard to imagine that kind of dystopian inequality. Unfortunately, I think we live with that in Cape Town already, and in the whole country already. And I think that climate change is going to make inequality worse. So unless we do something about that to ameliorate the effects on the poorest in our society, I do see quite a nightmarish future ahead of us. I think we need to rethink about how our economy is structured in terms of that. There's that quote, and I never remember who said it, but I think it's so pertinent to this, is that dystopia is when something is happening to us rather than them. Mm-hmm. So it's also trying to imagine, you know, many people in the world already live in a kind of nightmarish dystopia. Yep. And so it's trying to make that feel real. And I wanted to do, as you've mentioned, sort of explore the process of that descent, because a lot of dystopian novels are set after some cataclysmic event. And I wanted to show what it feels like to go through the downfall. On the technology angle, it was also sort of extrapolating current trends and how we currently interact with technology. I mean, I myself find it hard to look away from my phone a lot of the time. I see my screen time report every week. And
you're not supposed to read those.
I know, it's horrifying. It's sort of like a digital pacifier, you know, and I think it's used more and more. And these technology companies want to hook us more and more into these addictive behaviors. And so I sort of imagine what it's like if the technology has access to our thoughts and our dreams, and we can avoid reality completely by distracting ourselves with streaming services all the time, 24/7.
And the characters in this novel literally have implants, VR implants in their brains, in their wrists to carry their banking details. They pay for something by swiping their wrist against a scanner. Again, something that's not that far distant in an imaginable future for us. But of course, the consequences thereof are catastrophic in terms of the total disconnection from one another. And I mean, disconnection from what is happening in the world outside. These people literally are living in a bubble, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I mean, the love story at the core of it is just beautiful. Your main characters are three gay friends, Lutando, Viwe and Malcolm, all in their own way trying to make sense of a world that is falling apart around them and also make peace with their own identities. And I mean, there is such a poignant thread in this book through Viwe, who struggles with his identity because he has been raised in a very religious home. He's been told all of his life that to be gay is evil, that what he is an abomination. And so when he finds himself falling in love and living with a man, it's a constant process of self-loathing and love. And there's that beautiful moment late in the book where Lutando says that he always hoped that if he loved Viwe enough, Viwe would come to love himself a little bit more. Again, it's something that I think a lot of people sadly would be able to relate to. I mean, talk to us a little bit about what you were wanting to create with that love story.
So the Viwe character still breaks my heart, even working with this book for as long as I've been working with it. I really did want to explore that idea of learning to love yourself and of queer shame. I think one of the many reasons I wanted to look at, wanted to make a gay character central in this book is firstly, I just don't think that happens enough in literature and in arts. But also, I'm interested in sort of how marginalized people will fare when things get violent and scary. And it's also personal experience. You know, there's always a lot of personal experience that goes into writing a novel, even when you fictionalize the characters and the world as much as I have. It's something that I've struggled with a lot myself, sort of learning to accept. I hope much less so nowadays, but I think it's still very difficult growing up gay and believing that, you know, you're wrong. And so I wanted to show a sort of journey towards loving oneself. Through that relationship and learning to accept yourself.
What is frightening is that as society decays and the climate decays, there is this terrible regression back into very, very deeply divided, very, very far right wing, I don't know what the word, very conservative, sort of there's a groundswell of support for that again. People looking for people to blame for what has happened, lashing out, as you say, at anybody who's different from them with really devastating results. You really centralize, though, I thought, the question of how much difference can one person make to stop that in its tracks, to reverse it or to stop it from happening in the first time. And I mean, you have these very different approaches. You have Lutando, who sees what is happening to the climate. He is somebody who is passionate about trees, and he starts with small acts of resistance, like going out in the middle of the night to do some guerrilla gardening and plant trees all over Cape Town, which is just delightful. But he becomes increasingly frustrated because nobody else is listening when he's shouting out, we've got to do something to stop this. And he becomes increasingly strident as this book progresses with devastating effects for him. Then you have Viwe, who is almost depressed about what is going on around him, and so depressed that he just is not able to functionally do anything about it. And then the third character of Malcolm, who is very vocal in the planning of resistance, but just doesn't show up when the pedal hits the metal. I mean, all of them have their impact in different ways. What are you trying to say about the power of one person to make a change?
So I'm not sure if I know what the answer is in that question. It is something that I wanted to explore, as you've said, and I think I myself oscillate between feeling a bit hopeless and feeling like, no, we've got this, we can do it, you know. So I wanted to show the various approaches of different types of personalities, and I did want to. The title should give away that I think that it doesn't have to be this way. You know, it's not too late for us to change the course that we're on. I just think it needs a sense of urgency and for us to work together. I think maybe one person on his own definitely or her own definitely can't do it. But
just for those who might have joined us late to the conversation, my guest with us in studio is Alistair Mackay, whose book is called It Doesn't Have to Be This Way, published by Quella Books. And just one of the most enjoyable things I've read all year, although I don't know if that's right to say enjoyable because it's horrific in content in places, but just so compelling. Malcolm, your tech fundy character, who at the start of the book believes that one day our human consciousness is going to be fully uploadable to the cloud and we will be free of the prisons of our bodies, contrasted with Lutando, who recognizes our bodies aren't prisons, they are our life rafts and they are incredibly easy to sink. Talk to us a little bit about the journey that Malcolm goes on when he finally starts to wake up to the real consequences of the work he's involved in.
Absolutely. So as you say, Malcolm tries to do the right thing, but I think he really struggles to know what that is. Mm. And he finds it hard to leave his comfort zone. And so as the book kind of goes on, and he is on the more privileged side of this unequal divide, he gets more and more distracted and more roped into distraction. And he ends up working in a field of sort of cognitive augmentation and mental software in the hope that he can sort of help people to reduce their trauma. Because he's seen how much trauma is going on around him and how much it's affected his two best friends, essentially. But even that path sort of leads down a dark, it's sort of hijacked almost by sort of corporate interests. It doesn't really go the way he's hoping it'll go. I don't want to give away how he resolves all of that at the end, but
there is a character arc for him. We can leave it at that. The one thing that really just the one paragraph I've been thinking about over and over again, I just want to read a little bit for our listeners if you'll indulge me, which really looks to the sort of the world beyond. And I have somebody's asked me on the SMS line whether the book is only focused on what's happening in Cape Town or whether it looks to the rest of the world as well. So I think without too many spoilers, we can say Cape Town is part of a larger world where this has happened everywhere, and the perimeters, Antarctica, Alaska, Canada, have become the only comfortably livable parts of the planet left. So I think it's Malcolm who reflects on where we've got to and the fact that looking around this world and beyond, nobody yet has perfected interstellar travel. And it really struck me. He says the following: if there are other civilizations out there, and there must be in a universe of this size, they have either used up their planets and died along with them, or they have survived by learning humility. The survivors do not fetishize expansion. They do not consume more than can be regrown. They accept their limitations and exist in equilibrium with their ecosystems, perhaps as small agrarian societies, content for the stars and for us to remain forever distant in the night sky. I read that, and of course, I immediately thought of certain billionaires flying off into space. Well, I don't know if you had them in mind when you wrote that.
I was thinking about that exact thing. But even so much of science fiction is sort of premised on this idea that we can colonize space, so we can expand throughout the universe, you know, and just not deal with our problems here on Earth by just going somewhere else. So I really wanted to turn that idea on its head.
The other thing that really is going to stay with me is your lead female character, Notolo's comment that is revealed to us secondhand via a letter, that enough is a decision, not a quantity. And I mean, there's so much in that short phrase, Alistair, about what it says about our ability to be individually responsible for the trajectory the planet is on, that it's up to us to say enough is enough and we don't have to mindlessly consume and always be looking for more in quantities the planet can't support. That really could be the calling card for this book, I think. Do you hope in a way that this book will sort of scare people a little bit, shake them out of their comfort zone and make them look at their excesses a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't want it to be preachy at all, but I absolutely, one of the main reasons why I wanted to write this book was to frighten people a little bit, because I think we're all sort of bumbling along and not sort of seeing this crisis that's heading down the tracks towards us. So I wanted to say, like, you know, wake up, this is actually very serious and very urgent. And I do think that all of our collective decisions on an individual level build up, you know. And if we're consuming less and making more conscious decisions, it'll hopefully make things not quite so bad.
Something that all of us can do, but then again, as you said at the start, it also requires a much bigger interaction and commitment on a global level. And that, you know, that is reflected at different points in this book where your characters sort of reference the fact here we are organizing a protest through the streets of Cape Town and China and the USA and the world's biggest economies are still happily burning their fossil fuels and doing nothing about it. Yeah. What difference can we make? I mean, the title says it all. It doesn't have to be this way. So yes, it is a call to individual action change. But I mean, would you like a politician to read this book and start thinking differently? What do you hope might come of it?
I mean, that would be amazing if I did get all the presidents of all the countries and the biggest corporations to read it. I do think that we're obviously not one of the largest economies in the world, but we actually are quite dirty for our size. Eskom's one of the dirtiest power producers on the planet. So I don't think we get a free pass.
The book is called It Doesn't Have to Be This Way. The author is Alistair Mackay, and it's published by Quella Books. I know it's in paperback in all the good bookstores. Is there an e-version available
there
as well?
There is, yes, on Kindle and Kobo and Nook and all the e-reader types.
Okay. Yeah. So no Columbia University demanding a chapter a day on the next one. Are you busy thinking about the next one already, or are you just enjoying this one finally being birthed into the world?
Yeah, I'm going to have to keep my own hours and be my own boss. No, I'm actually quite far along into the next one already. I've been working on it throughout the pandemic, so hopefully it won't be too long until that.
And am I allowed to ask some of the theme or something completely different?
No, it's actually it's very different. It's a very different book. It's more about fatherhood and childhood trauma and adoption. It's about a gay couple adopting a child in Cape Town and what happens through that process.
Well, based on what I've read here, I can't wait to read that as well. Right. Alistair, really, this has been, it's just a fabulous read, and it will really make you take a step back and look hard at your lifestyle and think about where we're going. And there is enough, as far in the future as it may be set, there is enough in it that is so recognizable in our present to really shake you in your boots a little bit. I think you've done a fantastic job, Alistair. Thanks for coming in to join us in studio today.
Thank you so much, Pippa. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
It Doesn't Have to Be This Way, published by Quella Books. You'll find it in all good bookstores now.